From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, yes, those open lines with a special Sell Your Soul hotline. So get ready for that. While a patched-up Atlantis blasted off with seven astronauts tonight on the first space shuttle flight of this year, putting NASA apparently back on track after a run of bad luck and scandal that included a damaging hailstorm and a love triangle. Its big orange fuel tank covered with white blotches where the foam insulation had been repaired, the spaceship rose from its seaside launch pad with a roar and climbed into a clear and still brightly lit sky at 7:38 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, setting a course for the International Space Station. Now, the countdown was nearly flawless, but it appeared that something fell from the tank more than 2 minutes into the ascent. Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, watched the flight. Richard, what do you think that was?
Well, it was obviously a piece of foam. The key thing is when it fell off. If foam falls off late, when the shuttle is basically up out of the atmosphere, no one cares because it's the airstream, you know, the 6, 7, 8,000 miles per hour through the atmosphere that will cause a small piece of foam, a few ounces in mass, to basically hit with the force of a stick of nitroglycerin. So you don't want things falling off low in the atmosphere. You don't really mind if they fall off when it gets almost into orbit.
Well, wasn't the foam the big problem with the Columbia disaster?
Well, yeah, but that's because it fell off, you know, about 60 seconds into the launch in the lower atmosphere when the shuttle was, you know, climbing up and it could do damage. I mean, I looked at some of the video that was linked back from the crew a few minutes ago on NASA TV, and the tank looked pretty clean. And that's interesting because, as you remember, in February when they had that freak hailstorm, they had 7,000 dings from hail that just peppered that sucker sitting there on the pad, and they spent 3 months repairing manually with putty knives and glue and foam and all that this tank. So the fact that the tank basically survived unscathed and nothing came off that would have threatened the shuttle. But again, we're kind of working on an old problem because, as I said last night, the main concern I now have is that every time we launch one of these missions, this is an 11-day mission with seven crew members to the space station, we have ticking time bombs in the shuttle, these huge tanks, these Kevlar tanks at 4,500 PSI that are pressurized with the hypergolic fuels for the reaction control system, and they were only rated, design life rated for 10 years, and they're 25 years and counting. Well, it turns out, George, that this is a bureaucratic nightmare. The company that made them 25 years ago has gone out of business.
So who repairs them? Who fixes them?
Nobody. NASA cannot commission and vet properly another firm to build replacement tanks before the shuttle itself is going to be retired in 2010. This is something so incredibly wrong that the bureaucracy is so behemoth and gargantuan and immobilized that it cannot get a company to basically make new tanks, get them man-rated, put them in the shuttle so that these things don't blow up under the floorboards. And we're going to have to live with this problem because, as the NASA tests have said, it turns out they don't fail slowly. In other words, they don't leak from the valves. They basically fail catastrophically when they fail, which means they blow up. They're like bombs. And this is just nuts. I mean, there's something running NASA that's wrong. And we need to do a show. I've got some experts, some policy people, some engineers. We need to do an entire show on what is wrong with the space program fundamentally, systemically, and how it could be made right. Because, frankly, the only people that can help now are this audience.
And let's also invite somebody from NASA to be
exactly
on that program.
Absolutely. Let's have a free and open discussion. Let's have all sides represented. But Griffin is making some very strange decisions. Do you realize that NASA destroyed some videotapes of internal Inspector General hearings a few months ago? And there's now hearings on the Hill in the House Committee, Oversight Committee, asking why NASA destroyed public documents. They didn't want someone to hear something, George, and that's why they destroyed public records. This is illegal. You cannot do that in Washington.
Well, it is indeed criminal, Richard. Indeed criminal.
And it needs airing, it needs the light of day, and it needs this audience to focus on the problems and the potential. You know, I'm coming out with a new book this fall on called The Dark Mission with Mike Barrad, The Secret History of NASA. We will have the most astonishing evidence of what NASA's been sitting on that's lying right next door on the moon. We should be going back at warp 9. It shouldn't take us twice as long because of money and misplaced priorities to get back to the moon than it took for us to get there when John Kennedy said, let's go, you know, 30 years ago.
Well, we continue.
Is wrong.
We're limping along here with this space program, Richard, until we come up with something new and innovative.
And we're not going to be able to come up with something new and innovative when we put our money into an albatross called the shuttle and the space station, he said, frankly.
Hey, by the way, make sure you're listening to our Monday night show with our special guest, Jay Widener.
Absolutely. Jay Widener is a hell of a guy, George. You are going to have one incredible coast ride. Jay and I have known each other for like a generation, 20-some years. We worked together. He's an exquisite, punctilious, bottom-line researcher. His stuff is solid. It's well-documented. And he is going to blow your minds with all kinds of things leading up to this incredible Mayan calendar date of 2012. Folks out there, you do not want to miss this. It's one of those be there or be square things. So mark on your calendars Monday night, the 11th, for Coast.
Thanks, Richard, for the update. And obviously, keep in touch with us as you monitor the shuttle and its mission to the ISS. Richard C. Hoagland. I don't know how many of you tonight saw Neil Cafuto on Fox News, but he was interviewing Buzz Aldrin, former astronaut. He was a guest by phone on the show, and they were talking about the Paris Hilton trip back to jail overshadowing the shuttle launch. And Buzz said something very fascinating. Basically, he said, look, if we were taking off and we saw a UFO out the window, we were smart enough to say it was the Stage 1 rocket ejecting in order not to take away attention from the launch. He went on to say, we were smart enough, instead of saying we would have been smart enough. Kind of interesting, wasn't it? I got many emails on that tonight. In Vancouver, in Canada, the green blood came as a bit of a shock to a Dr. Alana Flexman and her colleagues when they tried to put an arterial line into a patient about to undergo surgery in Vancouver's St. Paul's Hospital. It wasn't the dark red blood that you normally see. It was dark green, sort of green-black. They say like an avocado. What the heck was it? Who was he? Well, after a series of tests, they detected what was called self-hemoglobin, a condition thought to be triggered by some medications. But for one moment, one very strange moment, they probably thought they had somebody from some other place. Fewer than half of the physicians who responded to a survey at a recent conference in Europe said that they thought an influenza pandemic was very likely. Now, that's fewer than half in the next few years, this according to a report in the journal Archives of Disease and Childhood. The findings, published early online, reveal that only 44.7% of the respondents took the view that an avian influenza pandemic is almost inevitable or very likely within the next few years. And as you know, we don't think it will be a pandemic at all based on the guests that have come on this program. An upset stomach forced President Bush to skip some meetings at the International Summit on Friday in Germany. Some bed rest led him and allowed him to rejoin the gathering and continue to Poland for talks for a new missile defense system. The aide said Mr. Bush likely fell ill with some sort of bug, probably more viral in nature than the food from the summit. Strange things going on in Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Olmert apparently is offering Syria the Golan Heights if Damascus and the regime cuts its ties with Iran and ends support for Palestinian terror groups. The Golan Heights is a strategic mountainous territory looking down on Israeli population centers, twice used by Syria to launch wars against the Jewish state. Mainstream U.S. and Israeli military experts have long maintained Israel must retain the Golan to ensure against a ground invasion from Syria. The U.S. Army is developing a robot that can recover injured or abducted soldiers from the battlefield. The remote-controlled battlefield extraction assist robot, called Bear, will be able to travel over rough terrain while carrying a casualty in its arms. According to New Science, a magazine, a prototype can easily lift more than 300 pounds with one arm and carry stairs holding a human-sized dummy and climb them. The robot, which has a rounded head and teddy bear-type looking ears and large eyes, can also carry a wounded soldier while kneeling or lying down, making covert rescues very possible. Man in California amputated his own leg with a penknife after being pinned under a tree for almost 11 hours. 66-year-old Al Hill was cutting trees near his remote home in Iowa Hill, California, when a tree fell on his leg and trapped him. He was alone, had no mobile phone signal. He was forced to take this horrible, drastic action. Eventually, a neighbor heard his screams and called for help. Scientists say they have a breakthrough which could lead to the end of the electric plug and power lead. This is an incredible story. A team from Massachusetts Institute of Technology say their machine, whatever they do, can beam power across a room. In the first successful trial of its kind, the team was able to illuminate a 60-watt light bulb 7 feet away. Now, they say most objects in the room, such as people, desks, carpets, would be unaffected. But any objects designed to resonate with the electromagnetic field would absorb the energy. Sounds just like Tesla technology, doesn't it? Well, in a moment, we're going to be talking with a certified paranormal investigator who has just returned from his very first seance. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, his name is Dom Vilela, and he is a paranormal investigator, a certified one. As a matter of fact, there is a story of Dom up there under Hot Stories at coasttocoastam.com. He's based in New York City. He heads up the Paranormal New York City, a not-for-profit organization offering a number of services, including EVP research, ghost hunting, ESP research, hypnotherapy, and spirit contact. He has been a featured expert on the paranormal for everyone, from David Letterman to the New York Times, and he went to his first seance tonight, and he's back. Dom, welcome to Coast. How are you?
Good. How are you doing this evening?
Good. It's good to talk with you. Tell me a little bit about this seance. How did you end up going to this?
Well, we were called to investigate the Merchant House Museum in, on 29 East 4th Street in Manhattan. And yesterday we began the investigation, and we just did, you know, a typical investigation. And then we were asked to come back for the second day to conduct a seance to try to see if we could probably bring back any of the spirits or call upon that were supposedly haunting the building. We were looking for a Gertrude Treadwell, who was in that house. I think she was born in 1840 and lived in that house until she was 92 years old. And it was believed she was the one haunting the house. So we called upon Richard Scholler, who's a medium from Long Island, to conduct the seance. And we started probably about, I'd say about 8 o'clock this evening. And
Dom, are these seances much like what we see in the movies and on television? People are gathered around a table and, you know, the lead seance medium does what he or she does?
Similar, except we didn't use a table. We basically had 11 people sit around in a circle of chairs. And everything else about the seance was pretty much traditional of what most people would expect to see in one. Which I was expecting the table too, though. So for being my first one, and not, you know, it was kind of one of those things. Oh, where's the table? All right, no table.
Why 11 people?
That was just the amount of people. There was three people from our team, Paranormal NYC, and there were people from the museum, and the medium brought also his assistant with him. So it was just that so many people, we didn't want to leave anybody out, and we were there pretty much just to make sure there was no fraud going on, and just to experience it also. I mean, it was great for us because I don't think anybody in the team had ever been on a seance before. And so it was like a great experience just to be able to be there.
All right, Dom, so when you investigate for fraud in a seance, what do you do? You get there before everyone starts, obviously, but what do you check out?
Well, we just make sure there's no hidden devices. We also, we do set up surveillance cameras and audio just to make sure nobody's trying to pull a fast one on us, because as you know, like sometimes you never know what you're walking into sometimes. So that way the infrared cameras really do come in helpful, because you could place them where you need them without anybody knowing. And that way you could check it back later to make sure there was absolutely no fraud. All right. And, tonight, we didn't witness any fraud, so thank God for that.
All right. Tell me now, when the medium started doing what he does,
right,
what did he try to do to conjure up Gertrude?
He was basically not really trying to conjure up Gertrude. He was just trying to sense for any spirit that might be in the building. And he never really came upon Gertrude. He was mentioning a couple names of the servants that were once there back in the 1800s and the early 1900s, but never really hit on Gertrude, but hit on, I would say, a good maybe three or four people that were connected to the building over the last 100 years. So he wasn't, like, completely accurate with the main people who lived in the building, but did pick out their profession. And but overall, it was definitely a successful seance. I mean,
What came in? Did you hear voices or anything like that?
No, we were kind of expecting it. You know, we were expecting, you know, at one point it seemed like he was going to go into a trance, and then, you know, he just didn't feel it. So we didn't hear anything. It was more of just experiencing certain things that happened without voices, no apparitions. So we didn't visually witness anything. Some people in the circle felt like they were seeing things moving. I myself did not see anything move. So there was one situation that I think that really stands out more than all the rest. Next to me is my partner from NYC called Dan. He was sitting next to me, and on his lap he had a towel, and his arm laying on the towel, and it was closest to me. And there was a woman to my left side in a chair, and out of nowhere the towel just was torn out of his underneath his arm, flew across me and landed in the woman next to me, her lap. Which that was the most startling thing, because we wouldn't have done anything like that for fraud reasons, obviously. And the woman, there was no way she could reach over me to grab the towel. So we were just trying to figure out exactly what would have caused this towel to move over 2 feet. But besides for that, anything like nothing drastic except for that. That really stood out as being the most impressionable thing about the whole night.
Did you get this on videotape, any chance, Dom?
We unfortunately, the angle that the camera was at was not aimed at me, so or Dan. It was aimed more at the medium, so we didn't catch. We didn't catch the towel moving from one person to another.
What did the people in the group say when they saw this happen? Oohs and ahs,
yeah, exactly.
Or are they quiet?
Yeah, everybody was kind of amazed, you know. And I think to a certain degree, you know, people didn't know that if it was set up that way or something like that. But we always try to avoid anything like that. You know, if it wasn't Dan sitting next to me, I would have maybe thought this was kind of set up. But I know him by working with him for the last 4 years. I know he's not the type of guy who would throw his towel across the room.
Yeah. Well, the medium who was conducting this seance, did you have an opportunity to talk with him after it was finished?
Yes, we did.
And what did he think about all of it?
He told me that he felt a lot of energy in the building, and he said there was a lot of, he felt like there was a lot of activity, and that he couldn't really pinpoint exactly, there was so many different people, so many different energies, he couldn't really narrow it down to like one person that was affecting or haunting the place. He felt like there were several different spirits that were in and out of the building. And, I mean, the building, it's been a museum since 1930, I think it was since 1936.
So that's a long time.
It's been a while, and it's all restored to exactly that time period. So all the furniture in there is exactly the same as it would have been back in the early 1900s.
Do you also get many orbs when you investigate, or EVPs?
Orbs, yes, but I mean, we kind of feel like there's three basic reasons you get an orb. It's either usually like reflection, dust, or energy. And energy, even with energy, we kind of feel like you're not really sure if every energy orb is going to be a spirit either. Static electricity could possibly cause that also. It's not that we don't believe orbs are spirits or not. We just usually try to dismiss anything that we can't have solid proof of. But EVPs, we've been kind of, I mean, on this one, we haven't checked the data yet, obviously, because we just finished it today.
Sure.
But, and since we started up in 2003, and since 2003, I think we maybe have two or three EVPs that are outstanding, that are just definitely not tampered with, very clear, very, you could understand the speech. And one was from Eastern State Penitentiary.
we put a microphone in one of his prison cells, and when we were listening back, we heard a voice saying, my house, my home.
Oh, man.
And that's a spooky thing to hear from a prison cell.
Yeah, it sure is.
You kind of wonder, like a prisoner, thinking of prison as his house.
Hey, Dom, stay with us. I've got some more questions for you. We'll also open up the phone lines. Those of you who want to interview a true certified paranormal investigator and ask him a question or two, Gertrude Treadwell is the person they tried to contact. She died at the age of 93 years old in that old merchant's house. She was in love with a doctor, but good old dad said, you two can't get married. She remained alone until her death, and she's never left the house since. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Friday, July 6th, I'll be doing the program live at Roswell, New Mexico, in tribute to their 60th anniversary of that incredible thing that crashed there. And Ian Punnett, who has Coast to Coast Live from Saturday, 6 p.m. to 10 p.m., will have a little bit of Roswell tomorrow. Will you not, Mr. Punnett?
I will. In fact, it's a witness to Roswell unmasking the 60-year cover-up. And I think it'll set the table well for your show coming up in July, and it's my first chance cracking this book. Have you seen it yet?
I have seen the snippets of it, Ian, and you are going to have a wonderful time with Don Schmidt. He's just a delight.
Hey, by the way, I'm looking forward to your TV show coming up next week.
It's coming up Wednesday. It'll be 11 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. Pacific, and it's on Ghost, so it's one of those topics that all of us hold so dear to our hearts.
Now, do you play, like, an eccentric attorney or a horny surgeon? What is your part exactly in the show?
I play the part of Ian Punnett.
Oh, so the eccentric, the nutty neighbor.
Exactly. Who is hauled off in a straitjacket after the program.
I haven't seen the show yet. Is this the first one?
Yeah, well, this is the first one. If it's successful ratings-wise, you know what that's all about.
Yeah. I think it's way cool. How many have you shot?
We shot two. One was on UFOs with Whitley Strieber and some other guests, and then this one is on Ghosts with Gary Busey, a case of a woman in Florida who sings. Now, you may not think that's unusual, but the woman is dead.
Yeah. So anything with Gary Busey, I think, is unusual.
Exactly. And it's taped before a live audience. But
really?
We're going to have fun with that. And in the meantime, you're back from your double duty from last Saturday. Art is back for Saturday and Sunday. And I'm looking forward to hearing you with Don Schmidt talking about Roswell.
Thank you. It'll be cool double duty to see you on TV and then hear you on Coast to Coast. So tomorrow night, good show. Hope people listen to Witness to Roswell, but I know I'll be watching you on TV with a live audience, like Phil Donahue. I mean, is that what you're doing, or like Springer?
Yeah, but I don't go flying through the audience. I had someone there for me.
Sounds great. Thanks.
All right, Ian. Thanks, and good luck to you. It's Ian Punnett. And we'll be back in a moment with your questions with our special paranormal investigator in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're with paranormal investigator Dom V. Lella. We'll take your phone calls as well. Dom, of all the places you've been, which was your most memorable investigation?
I would definitely have to say the Ed Sullivan Theater for David Letterman's show. We were called in by them to originally just to do a skit with Rupert, the deli guy.
Yeah.
And what turned out was when we got there, I kind of like weaseled my way into getting maybe like 6 hours that we could have the whole theater to ourselves just to do a pretty good investigation. And they went for it. So we had a good 6 hours with just me and three other investigators in the Ed Sullivan Theater. And I mean, this is, of course, a show I grew up on. And that theater alone, that's like a staple in New York. You know, that's one of the best theaters around.
Well, who died in there?
That's the thing about it, is the history of it. That was originally, obviously Ed Sullivan, but also the Honeymooners were filmed in that studio.
Yeah, I mean, but Ed didn't die in the theater.
No, none of those people died in there. But it says over time, there were so many people, stagehands or other people who, accidents and stuff like that. Again, but nothing concrete, nothing that we could say, okay, well, we went in there and there's a haunting, but they know who it is. Nobody knew who supposedly was the haunted ghost in Ed Sullivan Theater. They just knew that weird things used to happen here and there.
Ah,
and the only thing we got an erratic, like, ball of light just bouncing around and then disappearing into a wall. Besides for that, it was just a great experience.
Do you go to these places, Dom, to clean it or just to witness it?
I think we go more to witness and then try to just try to find out exactly what's going on. So whether and not necessarily always to disprove, although a lot of times you walk into a situation and it's more to find out when you're looking for the truth, you end up ruling out a lot of things that are not paranormal that people might think are. So you end up with a bunch of, I would say, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've heard this so many times over and over again, that electromagnetic fields seem to be the big cause of paranormal activity. The problem is they also are the cause of hallucinations. So if there's like electronic gear that's very high in electromagnetic fields, you wonder if people are sleeping by, just say, an alarm clock with a high reading or something like that, if that might be the cause of possibly seeing things or hearing things.
Let's take some calls. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Oh.
Yeah, go ahead. Good.
Good. I just got a question. My family's always had, my mother and my grandmother has always had this, like, slight ESP. And they can tell when stuff's going to happen to me and whatnot. And I seem to be getting it a little bit, too, from time to time. But it seems like a couple days before I do, I'll be laying in my bed, and I just close my eyes. And then all of a sudden, I feel like I've, like, lifted out of my body. And then, like, a day or two after that happens, I predict something that's going to happen. But what can you...
What's happening to him, Dom?
That sounds like you're having an out-of-body experience. And then if you are, sometimes in that state, you might be getting information from another source. Do you feel like you're definitely leaving your body? Or do you feel
I start to, and it feels like all my skin is lifted off, all in there. I'm really skinny, and, it scares me. You know, it feels almost like I'm dying almost.
Do you ever see your own body? Like, are you ever looking down at yourself?
No, I've never made it that far. I always get scared and pull myself out of it.
Are you always awake when this happens, or you're asleep when it happens?
I'm awake.
You're wide awake.
Yep. And then like a day or two after it happens, I predict something that's going to happen to somebody close to my family.
But are you sure they're connected? I mean, there may not be a connection. One might be a physical problem, and the other one just might be a coincidence that you just happen to be getting that information 3 days later. But how often does that happen to you?
That's happened about 7 or 8 times.
And how far in between them?
Usually a day, no longer than a week.
That's pretty good, Dom, 7 or 8 times with the... being that repetitious so close.
Right. So that means there might be it seems like there is a connection to between the phenomena and the ESP, I guess, the information you're getting. Now, how accurate is the information you're getting?
It's not that good. It's usually I can pinpoint it to a certain person in my family. After it happens a couple of days after, I just get a weird feeling over me, and I'll call, say, my mom, say, my grandma. And I'll say, you know, something bad happened today, and, you know, something bad happened.
So, I mean, you said, though, it kind of runs in your family, too, though. So, I mean, if it runs in your family...
Yeah, but they've never had, like, the out-of-body experience, kind of like what I think it is.
Well, you don't sound like you're really having an out-of-body experience, though, because you say that you don't actually leave your body. You're just experiencing this kind of feeling that comes over you, and then that feeling might be... what's kind of like opening the door for you to pick up any other, maybe any psychic energy that's out there.
Jason is tuned on, Dom, I think. He's probably been, as I say, in the groove.
Right.
And I guess he can maximize it. Do you have any special tests for people like Jason? I mean, is there any kind of equipment you can hook him up to or anything like that?
Well, we do ESP tests to see if anybody, you know, has any high levels of ESP. And it's mainly observation. There's not really, a lot of times people who have, like, psychic powers don't usually do well in controlled environments. So if you try to test somebody in a controlled environment, they don't usually do well. When they're in their own environment, they usually do much better. So it's very hard. I mean, when you see people being hooked up to probes,
And then try to get an accurate reading that way. Because I think a lot of times being tested, we all get a little nervous. So I think most people aren't going to do that well if they're, you know, poked and prodded.
Let's go to our first time caller line. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Hello.
This is John in Wickenburg, Arizona, 50 miles west of Phoenix.
Sure thing. Go ahead, John.
I'm a first time caller, George, but I've been listening to Coast to Coast for probably at least 10 or 12 years. I'm kind of nervous.
You're doing well. Thanks. And thanks for supporting us so long.
Even back as far as when Art Bell accidentally super glued his lips together just before he came on the radio. You don't ask me about that. I was going to ask your guest if any of these ghosts ever materialized in front of him so he could see them, and if he ever used someone with a high consciousness level of spirituality to tell them to go to the light so they'd be free from this earth.
Well, that's one of the methods I think most investigators will use, we've never actually witnessed a full-body apparition. But when we are on an investigation and a person feels like their house is haunted, we will always try to speak to the spirit that's there. We will always comment for the spirit to move into the light or to just move on to a higher plane. But that's something we usually do.
Very good. Okay, thank you.
All right, John. Appreciate you being a first-time caller and you are welcome to call in anytime you want. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good. Where are you?
I am in Salisbury, North Carolina.
Okay, Brian.
I'm surprised I got through. I never get to get through to talk to you.
It's all odds, my friend.
I'm telling you.
Chance.
I have a couple questions for your guest. My first question is, what is the best way to start your paranormal group?
Let's go with that one first.
Okay. I mean, I always tell everybody, if you're really serious about starting a paranormal group, the best thing, the most important thing you need is education within the field. And, of course, there's no colleges for paranormal investigators. But what you can do is read up on a lot of books. There's a lot of really great authors out there with some great material. And really study your material for a long time. By reading a couple books doesn't make anybody a paranormal investigator. A lot of it comes from experience and education. And the two together, and put a lot of time into it. And it's not a very appealing, remember, we're not making any money from it. You do it as a passion only. So when you go into it, you got to realize you're never going to make anything from it. But you get a lot back by helping other people.
Right, yeah. And see, both of us have always been somewhat connected and always been real interested in it and had different experiences and this kind of thing. So I was curious about how to get one started. My next question is, you said you had investigated the Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia, is that right?
Yes, I have.
You guys wouldn't happen to have been part of the most haunted investigation last week, would you?
No, we weren't. We actually did, this was, I think, last summer, we investigated Eastern State Penitentiary.
Right, okay. I was wondering, there's a lot of neat things that happened in there. George, have you ever had the opportunity or the means to ever get in touch with any of the crew from Most Haunted Event Fielding or any of them that have the Most Haunted program on the Travel Channel?
I've had the Ghost Hunters on. I have not had those people on. But that's well worth looking into.
Yeah, that's really great, really good group. They're really intense as far as their investigations.
Okay, we shall do that. You almost choked to death, Dom, in New York City, right?
Yeah, for my article in Gothamist, right? They asked me to tell them an odd New York story. So my odd New York story was back when I was probably a teenager, I was eating lunch. I was taking a break from my job, and I was eating lunch, and I forgot what I was eating. I think it was a sandwich. And a piece of meat got stuck in my throat, and I started to choke, and I'm looking around, like, waving at people that I'm choking, and people kept just walking right past me.
Oh.
Nobody, everybody ignored me. And some people, like, looking at me like I was crazy. And then there was this, like, concrete slab that I just rammed my stomach into just to eject the piece of meat from my throat. And meanwhile, I'm sitting there. My eyes are tearing. And I'm looking around, and people are, like, looking at me, like, rolling their eyes.
You know, like one woman thought I was a drug addict. Meanwhile, I almost died in the middle of Manhattan. Nobody tried to help me.
Isn't that horrible when you start to choke? I mean, if people, I talked a little bit about this last week. Sometimes in the beginning, you don't want to do anything because you don't want to embarrass yourself, because you don't realize just how serious and bad it could be. But then it gets to a point where you're really in trouble.
Right, yeah, because, I mean, you can't breathe. I mean, and you know it's just only a matter of time that you could die from this. So you do what you have to do. It was a scary situation. I said, but it amazed me, the reaction of people. I was like, wow, New York is weird like that.
My uncle used to chew maybe 50, 60 times before he'd swallow. And he was like a cow out there in the pasture. And we would always laugh at him. But let me tell you, he never choked.
Yeah, there you go. That's the way to do it. Chew your food good.
West of the Rockies, it's your turn. Hi there.
Hey, George.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Hey, I've had a couple of girlfriends since my name is Brett in Woodbridge.
That's in California.
Yeah, Woodbridge, California. We make a lot of wine out here in this area, but one of my last girlfriends was a white witch.
Uh-huh. She
considered herself a good witch.
Yes.
And I was wondering if the guests had any differences between the dark and the white, or what I should look out for.
Any experience with witches, Dom?
I'm necessarily, even whether it be witches or anything else. Remember, in life, we always have good people and we have bad people. And I think automatically that's where the labels come from, good or bad. Good witch, bad witch, evil, good. I don't necessarily think that everything that is a bad witch doesn't necessarily always mean an evil one or a good witch. People are people. I just think that trying to decide whether a witch, a white witch, or what to look for with a dark witch, I never came across anybody who believed they were a dark witch. So that would be kind of a difficult question to answer.
We've got a white witch on the program quite a bit. She's a regular with Art, and I've chatted with her a couple times, Evelyn Paglini. And she was going to help me out on a Ouija board assignment. I'm not so sure she's going to anymore. I think she's a little concerned about it.
Oh.
Would you be, if you were doing a show on Ouija boards,
no.
to prove that it's the individual, not the Ouija board, that does what it does?
I most of the time, any type of research I've done with Ouija boards, I've come to that conclusion, that it's always the individual. We play a much bigger role in that. It's a lot of what you kind of subconsciously want also. And if you have two people doing it, you are almost guiding each other in a way.
Tell us about your website, Dom. A lot of people would love to do some research on what you do.
We are at www.paranormal-nyc.com. And we serve the entire New York City, New York State area.
How'd you get involved in ghost hunting?
I started out, honestly, since 1998 studying parapsychology. My goal in life was to become a parapsychologist. And then when it turns out, there's no colleges for that either. I started studying psychology and still studying on my own parapsychology. And in 2003, I figured I have all this education and I'm doing absolutely nothing with it. So I figured I'd start a group kind of more researching the parapsychology end of it. And I offered kind of spirit research and ghost hunting. And out of everything I was doing, that kind of triggered more than anything else. And I was getting a lot more calls from people who wanted to find out if their house was haunted rather than finding out whether they had ESP or not.
That's amazing. Well, you do great work, Dom. I want to thank you for being on the program with us this hour. And maybe when you get some good EVP sounds, you might want to get them our way, and we'll get you and maybe some of your other staff members back on the program, all right?
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, that's Dom Villela, and he is a certified paranormal investigator based in New York City. Now, I'll be back in a moment. 3 hours of open lines. I'm going to open up a special hotline because the question of the night: would you sell your soul for a wish? I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.